makeshift table behind which he was standing, a slab of fiberboard on two bright orange sawhorses. On the fiberboard were three red-backed bicycle cards. He turned them over with quick, graceful gestures. His fingers were long and perfectly white, Bobby saw, not a bit of sun color on them. The card in the middle was the Queen of Hearts. The man in the bowler picked it up, showed it to them, walked it dexterously back and forth between his fingers. "Fine, the lady in red, Shershila Fum Rouge, that's what it's all about and all you have to do," he said. "It's as easy as can be. Easy Japanese, easy as knittin' kitten britches." He beckoned Yvonne Loving. "Come on over, dollface, and show 'em how it's done." Yvonne, still giggling and blushing to the roots of her black hair, shrank back against Rianda and murmured that she had no more money for games, it was all spent. "Not a problem," the man in the bowler hat said. "It's just a demonstration, dollface. I want your mom and her pretty friend to see how easy it is." "Neither one's my mom," Yvonne said, but she stepped forward. "We really ought to get going if we're going to beat the traffic, Evie," Mrs. Gerber said. "No, wait a minute. This is fun," Rianda said. "It's three-card Monte. Looks easy, just like he says, but if you're not careful, you start chasing and go home dead broke." The man in the bowler hat gave her a reproachful look, then a broad and engaging grin. It was the grin of a low man, Bobby thought suddenly. Not one of those Ted was afraid of, but a low man, just the same. "It's obvious to me," said the man in the bowler, "that at some point in your past you have been the victim of a scoundrel. Although how anyone could be cruel enough to mistreat such a beautiful, classy dame is beyond my ability to comprehend." The beautiful, classy dame, 5'5" or so, 200 pounds or so, shoulders and face slathered with ponds, laughed happily. "Stow the guff and show the child how it works, and are you really telling me this is legal?" The man behind the table tossed his head back and also laughed. "At the ends of the midway, everything's legal until they catch you and throw you out, as I think you probably know. Now, what's your name, dollface?" "Yvonne," she said in a voice Bobby could barely hear. Beside him, Sully John was watching with great interest. "Sometimes folks call me Evie." "Okay, Evie, look right here, pretty baby. What do you see? Tell me their names. I know you can't a smart kid like you, and point when you tell. Don't be afraid to touch either. There's nothing crooked here. This one on the end is the jack. This one on the other end is the king. And this is the queen. She's in the middle." "That's it, dollface. In the cards, as in life, there is so often a woman between two men. That's their power. And in another 5 or 6 years, you'll find it out for yourself." His voice had fallen into a low, almost hypnotic chanting. "Now watch closely and never take your eyes from the cards." He turned them over so their backs showed. "Now, dollface, where's the queen?" Yvonne Loving pointed at the red back in the middle. "Is she right?" the man in the bowler asked the little party gathered around his table. "So far," Rianda said, and laughed so hard her uncorseted belly jiggled under her sundress. Smiling at her laughter, the low man in the bowler hat flicked one corner of the middle card, showing the red queen. 100% correct, sweetheart. So far, so good. Now watch. Watch close. It's a race between your eye and my hand. Which will win? That's the question of the day." He began to scramble the three cards rapidly about on his plank table, chanting as he did so, "Up and down, all around, in and out, all about, to and fro, watch 'em go, now they're back, they're side by side, so tell me, dollface, where's she hide?" As Yvonne studied the three cards, which were indeed once more lined up side by side, Sully leaned close to Bobby's ear and said, "You don't even have to watch him mix 'em around. The queen's got a bent corner, do you see it?" Bobby nodded and thought, "Good girl," when Yvonne pointed hesitantly to the card on the far left, the one with the bent corner. The man in the bowler turned it over and revealed the Queen of Hearts.
"Good job," he said. "You've a sharp eye, dollface, a sharp eye indeed."
"Thank you," Yvonne said, blushing and looking almost as happy as Carol had looked when Bobby kissed her.
"If you'd bet me a dime on that go, I'd be giving you back 20 cents right now," the man in the bowler hat said. "Why, you ask? Because it's Saturday, and I call Saturday twofer day. Now, would one of you ladies like to risk a dime
In a race between your young eyes and my tired old hands, you can tell your husbands,
lucky fellows they are to have you too, may I say,
that Mr. Herb McQuown, the Monty man at Seven Rock, paid for your day's parking. Or what about a quarter? Point out the Queen of Hearts and I give you back 50 cents.
Half a rock, yeah, Sully John said. I got a quarter, mister, and you're on.
Johnny, it's gambling, Carol's mother said doubtfully. I don't really think I should allow...
Go on, let the kid learn a lesson,
Rhonda said. Besides, the guy may let him win. Suck the rest of us in. She made no effort to lower her voice, but the man in the bowler, Mr. McGowan, only looked at her and smiled. Then he returned his attention to S.J.
Let's see your money, kid. Come on, pony up.
Sully John handed over his quarter. McQuown raised it into the afternoon sunlight for a moment, one eye closed.
Yeah, looks like a good one to me,
he said, and planked it down on the board to the left of the three-card lineup. He looked in both directions, for cops maybe, then tipped the cynically smiling Rhonda a wink before turning his attention back to Sully John.
What's your name, fella?
John Sullivan. McQuown widened his eyes and tipped his bowler to the other side of his head, making the plastic sunflower nod and bend comically.
A name of note. You know what I refer to?
Sure, someday maybe I'll be a fighter too, S.J. said. He hooked a left and then a right at the air over McQuown's makeshift table.
Pow, pow!
Pow, pow indeed, said McQuown. And how's your eyes, Master Sullivan?
Pretty good. And get them ready, because the race is on. Yes, it is. Your eyes against my hands. Up and down, all around. Where'd she go? I don't know.
The cards, which had moved much faster this time, slowed to a stop. Sully started to point, then drew his hand back, frowning. Now there were two cards with little folds in the corner. Sully looked up at McQuown, whose arms were folded across his dingy undershirt. McQuown was smiling. Take your time, son, he said. The morning was whiz-bang, but it's been a slow afternoon. Men who think hats with feathers in the brims are sophisticated, Bobby remembered Ted saying. The sort of men who'd shoot craps in an alley and pass around a bottle of liquor in a paper bag during the game. McQuown had a funny plastic flower in his hat instead of a feather. And there was no bottle in evidence. But there was one in his pocket. A little one. Bobby was sure of it. And toward the end of the day, as business wound down and totally sharp hand-eye coordination became less of a priority to him, McQuown would take more and more frequent nips from it. Sully pointed to the card in the far right.
No, S.J.,
Bobby thought. And when McQuown turned that card up, it was the king of spades. McQuown turned up the card on the far left and showed the jack of clubs. The queen was back in the middle.
Sorry, son, a little slow that time. Ain't no crime. Want to try again now that you're warmed up?
Gee, that was the last of my dough. Sully John looked crestfallen.
Just as well for you, kid, Rhonda said. He'd take you for everything you own and leave you standing here in your shorty shorts.
The girls giggled wildly at this. S.J. blushed. Rhonda took no notice of either.
I worked at Revere Beach for quite a while when I lived in Mass, she said. Let me show you kids how this works. Want to go for a buck, pal? Or is that too sweet for you?
In your presence, everything would be sweet, McQuown said sentimentally and snatched her dollar the moment it was out of her purse. He held it up to the light, examined it with a cold eye, then set it down to the left of the cards.
Looks like a good one, he said. Let's play, darling. What's your name?
Puddin'-tane, Rhonda said. Ask me again, and I'll tell you the same.
Ree, don't you think,
Anita Gerber began.
I told you, I'm wise to the gaff, Rhonda said.
Run 'em, my pal.
Without delay,
McQuown agreed, and his hands blurred the three red-backed cards into motion, up and down, all around, to and fro, watch them go. Finally settling them in a line of three again, and this time, Bobby observed with amazement all three cards had those slightly bent corners. Rhonda's little smile had gone. She looked from the short row of cards to McQuown, then down at the cards again, and then at her dollar bill lying off to one side and fluttering slightly in the little sea breeze that had come up. Finally, she looked back at McQuown. You suckered me, Pally, she said, didn't you?
No, McQuown said.
I raced you. Now, what do you say?
I think I say that was a real good dollar that didn't make no trouble and I'm sorry to see it go. Rianda replied and pointed to the middle card. McQuown turned it over, revealed the king, and made Rianda's dollar disappear into his pocket. This time the queen was on the far left. McQuown, a dollar and a quarter richer, smiled at the folks from Harwich. The plastic flower tucked into the brim of his hat nodded to and fro in the salt-smelling air. "Who's next?" he asked. "Who wants to race his eye against my hand?"
"I think we're all raced out," Mrs. Gerber said. She gave the man behind the table a thin smile, then put one hand on her daughter's shoulder and the other on her sleepy-eyed son's, turning them away.
"Mrs. Gerber?" Bobby asked. For just a moment he considered how his mother, once married to a man who had never met an inside straight he didn't like, would feel if she could see her son standing here at Mr. McQuown's slapdash table with that risky Randy Garfield red hair gleaming in the sun. The thought made him smile a little. Bobby knew what an inside straight was now. Flushes and full houses, too, he had made inquiries.
"May I try?"
"Oh, Bobby, I really think we've had enough, don't you?"
Bobby reached under the Kleenex he had stuffed into his pocket and brought out his last three nickels.
"All I have is this," he said, showing first Mrs. Gerber and then Mr. McQuown. "Is it enough?"
"Son," McQuown said, "I have played this game for pennies and enjoyed it."
Mrs. Gerber looked at Rianda.
"Ah, hell," Rianda said and pinched Bobby's cheek. "It's the price of a haircut, for Christ's sake. Let him lose it, and then we'll go home."
"All right, Bobby," Mrs. Gerber said and sighed. "If you have to."
"Put those nickels down here, Bob, where we can all look at them," said McQuown. "They look like good uns to me." "Yes, indeed. Are you ready?"
"I think so."
"Then here we go. Two boys and a girl go into hiding together. The boys are worthless. Find the girl and double your money."
The pale, dexterous fingers turned the three cards over. McQuown spieled and the cards blurred. Bobby watched them move about the table but made no real effort to track the queen. That wasn't necessary.
"Now they go, now they slow, now they rest. Here's the test." The three red-backed cards were in a line again. "Tell me, Bobby, where's she hide?"
"There," Bobby said, and pointed to the far left.
Sully groaned. "It's the middle card, you jerk. This time I never took my eye off it."
McQuown took no notice of Sully. He was looking at Bobby. Bobby looked back at him. After a moment, McQuown reached out and turned over the card Bobby had pointed at. It was the Queen of Hearts.
"What the heck?"
Sully cried. Carol clapped excitedly and jumped up and down. Rianda Hewson squealed and smacked him on the back.
"You took him to school that time, Bobby, attaboy!"
McQuown gave Bobby a peculiar, thoughtful smile, then reached into his pocket and brought out a fistful of change.
"Not bad, son. First time I've been beat all day. That I didn't let myself get beat, that is."
He picked out a quarter and a nickel and put them down beside Bobby's 15 cents.
"Like to let it ride?"
He saw Bobby didn't understand.
"Like to go again?"
"May I?" Bobby asked Anita Gerber.
"Wouldn't you rather quit while you're ahead?" she asked, but her eyes were sparkling and she seemed to have forgotten all about beating the traffic home.
"I am going to quit while I'm ahead," he told her.
McQuown laughed. "A boasty boy! Won't be able to grow a single chin whisker for another 5 years, but he's a boasty boy already! Well then, boasty Bobby, what do you think? Are we on for the game?"
"Sure," Bobby said. If Carol or Sully John had accused him of boasting, he would have protested strongly. All his heroes, from John Wayne to Lucky Star of the Space Patrol, were modest fellows, the kind to say shucks after saving a world or a wagon train. But he felt no need to defend himself to Mr. McQuown, who was a low man in blue shorts and maybe a card cheater as well. Boasting had been the furthest thing from Bobby's mind. He didn't think this was much like his dad's inside straights, either. Inside straights were all hope and guesswork. Fool's poker, according to Charlie Yearman, the Harwich Elementary janitor who had been happy to tell Bobby everything about the game that S.J. and Denny Rivers hadn't known. But there was no guesswork about this. Mr. McQuown looked at him a moment longer. Bobby's calm confidence seemed to trouble him. Then he reached up, adjusted the slant of his bowler, stretched out his arms and wiggled his fingers like Bugs Bunny before he played the piano at Carnegie Hall in one of the Merry Melodies. "Get on your mark, boasty boy. I'm giving you the whole business this time, from the soup to the nuts." The cards blurred into a kind of pink film. From behind him, Bobby heard Sully John mutter, "Holy crow!" Carol's friend Tina said, "That's too fast," in an amusing tone of prim disapproval. Bobby again watched the cards move, but only because he felt it was expected of him. Mr. McQuown didn't bother with any patter this time, which was sort of a relief. The cards settled. McQuown looked at Bobby with his eyebrows raised. There was a little smile on his mouth, but he was breathing fast, and there were beads of sweat on his upper lip. Bobby pointed immediately to the card on the right. "That's her." "How do you know that?" Mr. McQuown asked, his smile fading. "How the hell do you know that?" "I just do," Bobby said. Instead of flipping the card, McQuown turned his head slightly and looked down the midway. The smile had been replaced by a petulant expression, downturned lips and a crease between his eyes. Even the plastic sunflower in his hat seemed displeased, its to-and-fro bob now sulky instead of jaunty. "No one beats that shuffle," he said. "No one has ever beaten that shuffle." Rhianda reached over Bobby's shoulder and flipped the card he had pointed at. It was the Queen of Hearts. This time all the kids clapped. The sound made the crease between Mr. McQuown's eyes deepen. "The way I figure, you owe old boasty Bobby here 90 cents, Rhianda said. "You gonna pay?" "Suppose I don't," Mr. McQuown asked, turning his frown on Rhianda. "What are you gonna do, Tubbo? Call a cop?"
"Maybe we ought to just go," Anita Gerber said, sounding nervous.
"Call a cop?"
"Not me," Rhianda said, ignoring Anita. She never took her eyes off McQuown. "A lousy 90 cents out of your pocket, and you look like Baby Huey with a load in his pants. Jesus wept." Except Bobby knew it wasn't the money. Mr. McQuown had lost a lot more than this on occasion. Sometimes when he lost, it was a hustle. Sometimes it was an out. What he was steamed about now was the shuffle. McQuown hadn't liked a kid beating his shuffle. "What I'll do," Rhianda continued, "is tell anybody on the midway who wants to know that you're a cheapskate, 90-cent McQuown, I'll call you. Think that'll help your business?"
"I'd like to give you the business," Mr. McQuown growled.
But he reached into his pocket, brought out another dip of change, a bigger one this time, and quickly counted out Bobby's winnings.
"There," he said, "90 cents. Go buy yourself a martini."
"I really just guessed, you know," Bobby said as he swept the coins into his hand and then shoved them into his pocket where they hung like a weight. The argument that morning with his mother now seemed exquisitely stupid. He was going home with more money than he'd come with, and it meant nothing. Nothing.
"I'm a good guesser."
Mr. McQuown relaxed. He wouldn't have hurt them in any case. He might be a low man, but he wasn't the kind who hurt people. He'd never subject those clever, long-fingered hands to the indignity of forming a fist. But Bobby didn't want to leave him unhappy. He wanted what Mr. McQuown himself would have called an out.
"Yeah," McQuown said. "A good guesser is what you are. Like to try a third guess, Bobby? Riches await."
"We really have to be going," Mrs. Gerber said hastily.
"And if I tried again, I'd lose," Bobby said. "Thank you, Mr. McQuown. It was a good game."
Yeah, get lost, kid."
Mr. McQuown was like all the other midway barkers now, looking farther down the line, looking for fresh blood.
Going home, Carol and her girlfriends kept looking at him with awe, Sully John with a kind of puzzled respect. It made Bobby feel uncomfortable. At one point, Rhianda turned around and regarded him closely.
"You didn't just guess," she said.
Bobby looked at her cautiously, withholding comment.
"You had a winkle."
"What's a winkle?"
"My dad wasn't much of a betting man, but every now and then he'd get a hunch about a number. He called it a winkle. Then he'd bet. Once he won $50, bought us groceries for a whole month. That's what happened to you, isn't it?"
"I guess so," Bobby said. "Maybe I had a winkle." When he got home, his mom was sitting on the porch glider with her legs folded under her. She had changed into her Saturday pants and was looking moodily out at the street. She waved briefly to Carol's mom as she drove away, watched as Anita turned into her own driveway and Bobby trudged up the walk. He knew what his mom was thinking. Mrs. Gerber's husband was in the Navy, but at least she had a husband. Also, Anita Gerber had an estate wagon. Liz had Shank's mare, the bus if she had to go a little farther, or a taxi if she needed to go into Bridgeport. But Bobby didn't think she was angry at him anymore, and that was good. "Did you have a nice time at 7, Bobby?" "Super time," he said, and thought, "What is it, Mom? You don't care what kind of time I had at the beach. What's really on your mind?" But he couldn't tell.
"Good. Listen, kiddo, I'm sorry we got into an argument this morning. I hate working on Saturdays." This last came out almost in a spit.
"It's okay, Mom." She touched his cheek and shook her head. "That fair skin of yours, you'll never tan, Bobby-O, not you. Come on in and I'll put some baby oil on that sunburn." He followed her inside, took off his shirt, and stood in front of her as she sat on the couch and smeared the fragrant baby oil on his back and arms and neck. Even on his cheeks, it felt good. He thought again how much he loved her, how much he loved to be touched by her. He wondered what she would think if she knew he had kissed Carol on the Ferris wheel. Would she smile? Bobby didn't think she would smile. And if she knew about McQuown and the cards. "I haven't seen your pal from upstairs," she said, recapping the baby oil bottle. "I know he's up there because I can hear the Yankees game on his radio, but wouldn't you think he'd go out on the porch where it's cool?" "I guess he doesn't feel like it," Bobby said. "Mom, are you okay?" She looked at him startled. "Fine, Bobby." She smiled, and Bobby smiled back. It took an effort because he didn't think his mom was fine at all. In fact, he was pretty sure she wasn't. He just had a winkle. That night, Bobby lay on his back with his heels spread to the corners of the bed, eyes open and looking up at the ceiling. His window was open, too, the curtains drifting back and forth in a breath of a breeze. And from some other open window came the sound of the platters. "Here in the afterglow of day, we keep our rendezvous beneath the blue." Farther away was the drone of an airplane, the honk of a horn. Rhianda's dad had called it a winkle, and once he'd hit the daily number for $50. Bobby had agreed with her, a winkle, sure I had a winkle, but he couldn't have picked a lottery number to save his soul. The thing was, Mr. McQuown knew where the queen ended up every time, and so I knew. Once Bobby realized that, other things fell into place. Obvious stuff, really, but he'd been having fun, and well, you didn't question what you knew, did you? You might question a winkle, a feeling that came to you right out of the blue, but you didn't question knowing. Except how? Did he know his mother was taping money into the underwear pages of the Sears catalog on the top shelf of her closet? How did he even know the catalog was up there? She'd never told him about it. She'd never told him about the blue pitcher where she put her quarters either, but of course he had known about that for years. He wasn't blind, even though he had an idea she sometimes thought he was. But the catalog, the quarters rolled and changed into bills, the bills then taped into the catalog. There was no way he could know about a thing like that. But as he lay there in his bed listening while Earth Angel replaced Twilight Time, he knew that the catalog was there. He knew because she knew. And it had crossed the front part of her mind. And on the Ferris wheel, he had known Carol wanted him to kiss her again because it had been her first real kiss from a boy, and she hadn't been paying enough attention. It had been over before she was completely aware it was happening. But knowing that wasn't knowing the future. No. It's just reading minds, he whispered, and then shivered all over as if his sunburn had turned to ice. Watch out, Bobby-O. If you don't watch out, you'll wind up as nuts as Ted with his low men. Far off in the town square, the clock began bonging the hour of 10. Bobby turned his head and looked at the alarm clock on his desk. Big Ben claimed it was only 9:52. All right, so the clock downtown is a little faster. Mine is a little slow. Big deal, McNeil. Go to sleep. He didn't think he could do that for at least a while. But it had been quite a day. Arguments with mothers, money won from three-card Monte dealers, kisses at the top of the Ferris wheel, and he began to drift in a pleasant fashion. Maybe she is my girlfriend, Bobby thought. Maybe she's my girlfriend after all. With the last premature bong of the town square clock still fading in the air, Bobby fell asleep. Five. Bobby reads the paper. Brown with a white bib. A big chance for Liz. Camp Broad Street. An uneasy week. Off to Providence. On Monday, after his mom had gone to work, Bobby went upstairs to read Ted the paper. Although his eyes were actually good enough to do it himself, Ted said he had come to enjoy the sound of Bobby's voice and the luxury of being read to while he shaved. Ted stood in his little bathroom with the door open, scraping foam from his face, while Bobby tried him on various headlines from the various sections. Viet skirmishes intensify? Before breakfast, thanks, but no thanks. Carts corralled, local man arrested? First paragraph, Bobby. When police showed up at his Pond Lane residence late yesterday, John T. Anderson of Harwich told them all about his hobby, which he claims is collecting supermarket shopping carts. He was very interesting on the subject, said Officer Kirby Malloy of the Harwich PD, but we weren't entirely satisfied that he'd come by some of the carts in his collection honestly. Turns out Malloy was right with Eversharp. Of the more than 50 shopping carts in Mr. Anderson's backyard, at least 20 had been stolen from the Harwich A&P and Total Grocery. There were even a few carts from the IGA market in Stansbury. Enough, Ted said, rinsing his razor under hot water and then raising the blade to his lathered neck, galumphing small-town humor in response to pathetic acts of compulsive larceny. I don't understand you. Mr. Anderson sounds like a man suffering from a neurosis, a mental problem, in other words. Do you think mental problems are funny? Gee, no. I feel bad for people with loose screws. I'm glad to hear you say so. I've known people whose screws were not just loose, but entirely missing. A good many such people, in fact. They are often pathetic, sometimes awe-inspiring, and occasionally terrifying, but they are not funny. Carts corralled, indeed. What else is there? Starlet killed in European road accident? Ugh, no. Yankees acquire infielder in trade with Senators? Nothing the Yankees do with the Senators interests me. Albini relishes underdog role? Yes, please read that. Ted listened closely as he painstakingly shaved his throat. Bobby himself found the story less than riveting. It wasn't about Floyd Patterson or Ingemar Johansson, after all. Sully called the Swedish heavyweight Ingi baby, but he read it carefully nevertheless. The 12-rounder between Tommy Hurricane Haywood and Eddie Albini was scheduled for Madison Square Garden on Wednesday night of the following week. Both fighters had good records, but age was considered an important, perhaps telling factor. Haywood, 23, to Eddie Albini's 36, and a heavy favorite. The winner might get a shot at the heavyweight title in the fall, probably around the time Richard Nixon won the presidency. Bobby's mom said that was sure to happen and a good thing. Never mind that Kennedy was a Catholic. He was just too young and apt to be a hothead. In the article, Albini said he could understand why he was the underdog. He was getting up in years a little, and some folks thought he was past it because he lost by TKO to Sugar Boy Masters in his last fight. And sure, he knew that Haywood outreached him and was supposed to be mighty savvy for a younger fellow, but he'd been training hard, Albini said, skipping a lot of rope and sparring with a guy who moved and jabbed like Haywood. The article was full of words like game and determined. Albini was described as being full of grit. Bobby could tell. The writer thought Albini was going to get the stuffing knocked out of him and felt sorry for him. Hurricane Haywood hadn't been available to talk to the reporter, but his manager, a fellow named I. Kleindienst, Ted had told Bobby how to pronounce the name, said it was likely to be Eddie Albini's last fight. He had his day, but his day is over, I. Kleindienst said. If Eddie goes six, I'm going to send my boy to bed without his supper. Irving Kleindienst's a kamai, Ted said.
A what?
A fool. Ted was looking out the window toward the sound of Mrs. O'Hara's dog. Not totally blank the way he sometimes went blank, but distant.
You know him?
Bobby asked.
No,
Ted said. He seemed first startled by the idea, then amused.
No, of him.
Sounds to me like this guy Albini is going to get creamed.
You never know. That's what makes it interesting.
What do you mean?
Nothing.
Go to the comics, Bobby. I want Flash Gordon, and be sure to tell me what Dale Arden's wearing.
Why?
Because I think she's a real hotsy-totsy, Ted said.
And Bobby burst out laughing. He couldn't help it. Sometimes Ted was a real card. A day later, on his way back from the Sterling House, where he had just filled out the rest of his forms for summer baseball, Bobby came upon a carefully printed poster thumbtacked to an elm in Commonwealth Park. Please help us find Phil. Phil is our Welsh corgi. Phil is 7 years old. Phil is brown with a white bib. His eyes are bright and intelligent. The tips of his ears are black. We'll bring you a ball if you say, hurry up, Phil. Call Housatonic 5-8337 or bring to 745 Highgate Avenue, home of the Sagamore family. There was no picture of Phil. Bobby stood looking at the poster for a fair length of time. Part of him wanted to run home and tell Ted, not only about this, but about the star and crescent moon he'd seen chalked beside the hopscotch grid. Another part pointed out that there was all sorts of stuff posted in the park. He could see a sign advertising a concert in the town square, posted on another elm right across from where he was standing, and he'd be nuts to get Ted going about this. These two thoughts contended with each other until they felt like two sticks rubbing together in his brain in danger of catching on fire. I won't think about it, he told himself, stepping back from the poster, and when a voice from deep within his mind, a dangerously adult voice, protested that he was being paid to think about stuff like this, to tell about stuff like this, Bobby told the voice to just shut up. And the voice did. When he got home, his mother was sitting on the porch glider again. this time mending the sleeve of a house dress. She looked up, and Bobby saw the puffy skin beneath her eyes, the reddened lids. She had a Kleenex folded into one hand. "Mom?" What's wrong was how the thought finished, but finishing it would be unwise, would likely cause trouble. Bobby had had no recurrence of his brilliant insights on the day of the trip to Savin Rock, but he knew her. The way she looked at him when she was upset, the way the hand with the Kleenex in it tensed, almost becoming a fist, the way she drew in breath and sat up straighter, ready to give you a fight if you wanted to go against her. "What?" she asked him. "Got something on your mind besides your hair?" "No," he said. His voice sounded awkward and oddly shy to his own ears. "I was at Sterling House. The list's up for baseball. I'm a Wolf again this summer." She nodded and relaxed a little. "I'm sure you'll make the Lions next year." She moved her sewing basket from the glider to the porch floor, then patted the empty place. "Sit down here beside me a minute, Bobby. I've got something to tell you." Bobby sat with a feeling of trepidation. She'd been crying, after all, and she sounded quite grave. But it turned out not to be a big deal, at least as far as he could see. "Mr. Biderman, Don, has invited me to go with him and Mr. Cushman and Mr. Dean to a seminar in Providence. It's a big chance for me." "What's a seminar?" "A sort of conference. People get together to learn about a subject and discuss it. This one is real estate in the 60s. I was very surprised that Don would invite me. Bill Cushman and Curtis Dean, of course, I knew they'd be going. They're agents, but for Don to ask me..." She trailed off for a moment, then turned to Bobby and smiled. He thought it was a genuine smile, but it went oddly with her reddened lids. "I've wanted to become an agent myself for the longest time, and now this, right out of the blue, it's a big chance for me, Bobby. It could mean a big change for us." Bobby knew his mom wanted to sell real estate. She had books on the subject and read a little out of them almost every night, often underlining parts. But if it was such a big chance, why had it made her cry? "Well, that's good," he said. "The Ginchiest, I hope you learn a lot." "When is it?" "Next week. The four of us leave early Tuesday morning and get back Thursday night around 8 o'clock. All the meetings are at the Warwick Hotel, and that's where we'll be staying. Don's booked the rooms. I haven't stayed in a hotel room for 12 years, I guess. I'm a little nervous." Did nervous make you cry? Bobby wondered. Maybe so if you were a grown-up, especially a female grown-up. "I want you to ask S.J. if you can stay with him Tuesday and Wednesday night. I'm sure Mrs. Sullivan," Bobby shook his head, "that won't work." "Why ever not?" Liz bent a fierce look at him. "Mrs. Sullivan has never minded you staying over before. You haven't gotten into her bad books somehow, have you?" "No, Mom. It's just that S.J. won a week at Camp Winnie." The sound of all those W's coming out of his mouth made him feel like smiling, but he held it in. His mother was still looking at him in that fierce way, and wasn't there a kind of panic in that look? Panic or something like it? "What's Camp Winnie? What are you talking about?" Bobby explained about S.J. winning the free week at Camp Winnawinaya and how Mrs. Sullivan was going to visit her sister in Wisconsin at the same time, plans which had now been finalized, big gray dog and all. "Damn it, that's just my luck," his mom said. She almost never swore. Said that cursing and what she called dirty talk was the language of the ignorant. Now she made a fist and struck the arm of the glider. "God damn it." She sat for a moment thinking. Bobby thought as well. His only other close friend on the street was Carol, and he doubted his mom would call Anita Gerber and ask if he could stay over there. Carol was a girl, and somehow that made a difference when it came to sleepovers. One of his mother's friends, the thing was, she didn't really have any. Except for Don Biderman, and maybe the other two that were going to the seminar in Providence. Plenty of acquaintances, people she'd say hi to if they were walking back from the supermarket or going to a Friday night movie downtown, but no one she could call up and ask to keep her 11-year-old son for a couple of nights. No relatives, either. At least none that Bobby knew of. Like people traveling on converging roads, Bobby and his mother gradually drew toward the same point. Bobby got there first, if only by a second or two. "What about Ted?" he asked, and then almost clapped his hand over his mouth. It actually rose out of his lap a little. His mother watched the hand settle back with a return of her old cynical half-smile, the one she wore when dispensing sayings like, "You have to eat a peck of dirt before you die," and "Two men looked out through prison bars, one saw the mud and one saw the stars." And, of course, that all-time favorite, "Life's not fair." "You think I don't know you call him Ted when the two of you are together?" she asked. "You must think I've been taking stupid pills, Bobby-o." She sat and looked out at the street. A Chrysler New Yorker slid slowly past, finny, fender-skirted and highlighted with chrome. Bobby watched it go by. The man behind the wheel was elderly and white-haired and wearing a blue jacket. Bobby thought he was probably all right. Old, but not low. "Maybe it'd work," Liz said at last. She spoke musingly, more to herself than to her son. "Let's go talk to Brodigan and see." Following her up the stairs to the third floor, Bobby wondered how long she had known how to say Ted's name correctly. A week? A month? From the start, Dumbo, he thought. From the very first day. Bobby's initial idea was that Ted could stay in his own room on the third floor while Bobby stayed in the apartment on the first floor. They'd both keep their doors open, and if either of them needed anything, they could call. "I don't believe the Kilgallens or the Proskys would enjoy you yelling up to Mr. Brodigan at 3 o'clock in the morning that you'd had a nightmare," Liz said tartly. The Kilgallens and the Proskys had the two small second-floor apartments. Liz and Bobby were friendly with neither of them. "I won't have any nightmares," Bobby said, deeply humiliated to be treated like a little kid. "I mean, jeepers." "Keep it to yourself," his mom said tartly. They were sitting at Ted's kitchen table, the two adults smoking Bobby with a root beer in front of him. "It's just not the right idea," Ted told him. "You're a good kid, Bobby, responsible and level-headed, but 11's too young to be on your own, I think." Bobby found it easier to be called too young by his friend than by his mother. Also, he had to admit that it might be spooky to wake up in one of those little hours after midnight and go to the bathroom knowing he was the only person in the apartment. He could do it. He had no doubt he could do it. But yeah, it would be spooky. "What about the couch?" he asked. "It pulls out and makes a bed, doesn't it?" They had never used it that way. Bobby was sure she'd told him once that it did. He was right, and it solved the problem. She probably hadn't wanted Bobby in her bed, let alone Brodigan. And she really hadn't wanted Bobby up here in this hot third-floor room. That he was sure of. He figured she'd been looking so hard for a solution that she'd look right past the obvious one. So it was decided that Ted would spend Tuesday and Wednesday nights of the following week on the pull-out couch in the Garfields' living room. Bobby was excited by the prospect. He would have 2 days on his own, 3 counting Thursday, and there would be someone with him at night when things could get spooky. Not a babysitter either, but a grown-up friend. It wasn't the same as Sully John going to Camp Winnie for a week, but in a way it was. Camp Broad Street, Bobby thought and almost laughed out loud. We'll have fun, Ted said. I'll make my famous beans and Frank's casserole. He reached over and ruffled Bobby's crew cut. If you're going to have beans and Frank's, it might be wise to bring that down, his mom said, and pointed the fingers holding her cigarette at Ted's fan. Ted and Bobby laughed. Liz Garfield smiled her cynical half-smile, finished her cigarette, and put it out in Ted's ashtray. When she did, Bobby again noticed the puffiness of her eyelids. As Bobby and his mother went back down the stairs, Bobby remembered the poster he had seen in the park, the missing corgi who would bring you a ball if you said, "Hurry up, Phil." He should tell Ted about the poster. He should tell Ted about everything. But if he did that and Ted left 149, who would stay with him next week? What would happen to Camp Broad Street? 2 fellas eating Ted's famous beans and Frank's casserole for supper, maybe in front of the TV, which his mom rarely allowed. and then staying up as late as they wanted. Bobby made a promise to himself. He would tell Ted everything next Friday, after his mother was back from her conference or seminar or whatever it was. He would make a complete report, and Ted could do whatever he needed to do. He might even stick around. With this decision, Bobby's mind cleared amazingly, and when he saw an upside-down for sale card on the Total Grocery bulletin board 2 days later, it was for a washer-dryer set, he was able to put it out of his thoughts almost immediately. That was, nevertheless, an uneasy week for Bobby Garfield, very uneasy indeed. He saw two more lost pet posters, one downtown and one out on Asher Avenue, half a mile beyond the Asher Empire. The block he lived on was no longer enough. He found himself going farther and farther afield in his daily scouting trips. And Ted began to have those weird blank periods with greater frequency. They lasted longer when they came, too. Sometimes he spoke when he was in that distant state of mind, and not always in English. When he did speak in English, what he said did not always make sense. Most of the time, Bobby thought Ted was one of the sanest, smartest, neatest guys he'd ever met. When he went away, though, it was scary. At least his mom didn't know. Bobby didn't think she'd be too cool on the idea of leaving him with a guy who sometimes flipped out and started talking nonsense in English or gibberish in some other language. After one of these lapses, when Ted did nothing for almost a minute and a half but stare blankly off into space, making no response to Bobby's increasingly agitated questions, it occurred to Bobby that perhaps Ted wasn't in his own head at all, but in some other world, that he had left Earth, as surely as those people in Ring Around the Sun, who discovered they could follow the spirals on a child's top to just about anywhere. Ted had been holding a Chesterfield between his fingers when he went blank. The ash grew long and eventually dropped off onto the table. When the coal grew unnervingly close to Ted's bunchy knuckles, Bobby pulled it gently free and was putting it out in the overflowing ashtray when Ted finally came back.
"Smoking?" he asked with a frown. "Hell, Bobby, you're too young to smoke."
"It's just putting it out for you. I thought..." Bobby shrugged, suddenly shy. Ted looked at the first two fingers of his right hand, where there was a permanent yellow nicotine stain. He laughed, a short bark with absolutely no humor in it. "Thought I was going to burn myself, did you?" Bobby nodded. "What do you think about when you go off like that? Where do you go?"
"That's hard to explain," Ted replied, and then asked Bobby to read him his horoscope.
Thinking about Ted's trances was distracting. Not talking about the things Ted was paying him to look for was even more distracting. As a result, Bobby, ordinarily a pretty good hitter, struck out 4 times in an afternoon game for the Wolves at Sterling House. He also lost 4 straight battleship games to Sully at SJ's house on Friday when it rained. "What the heck's wrong with you?" Sully asked. "That's the 3rd time you called out squares you already called out before. Also, I have to practically holler in your ear before you answer me. What's up?"
"Nothing." That was what he said. "Everything." That was what he felt.
Carol also asked Bobby a couple of times that week if he was okay. Mrs. Gerber asked if he was off his feed. Yvonne Loving wanted to know if he had mono, then giggled until she seemed in danger of exploding. The only person who didn't notice Bobby's odd behavior was his mom. Liz Garfield was increasingly preoccupied with her trip to Providence, talking on the phone in the evenings with Mr. Biderman or one of the other two who were going. Bill Cushman was one of them. Bobby couldn't exactly remember the name of the other guy. Laying clothes out on her bed until the spread was almost covered. then shaking her head over them angrily and returning them to the closet, making an appointment to get her hair done, and then calling the lady back and asking if she could add a manicure. Bobby wasn't even sure what a manicure was. He had to ask Ted. She seemed excited by her preparations, but there was also a kind of grimness to her. She was like a soldier about to storm an enemy beach or a paratrooper who would soon be jumping out of a plane and landing behind enemy lines. One of her evening telephone conversations seemed to be a whispered argument. Bobby had an idea it was with Mr. Biderman, but he wasn't sure. On Saturday, Bobby came into her bedroom and saw her looking at two new dresses. Dressy dresses. One with thin little shoulder straps and one with no straps at all, just a top like a bathing suit. The boxes they had come in lay tumbled on the floor with tissue paper foaming out of them. His mom was standing over the dresses looking down at them with an expression Bobby had never seen before. Big eyes, drawn together brows, taut white cheeks, which flared with spots of rouge. One hand was at her mouth, and he could hear bone-like clittering sounds as she bit at her nails. A cool smoldered in an ashtray on the bureau, apparently forgotten. Her big eyes shuttled back and forth between the two dresses. "Mom?" Bobby asked, and she jumped, literally jumped into the air. Then she whirled on him, her mouth drawn down in a grimace. "Jesus Christ," she almost snarled. "Don't you knock?" "I'm sorry," he said, and began to back out of the room. His mother had never said anything about knocking before. "Mom, are you all right?" "Fine!" She spied the cigarette, grabbed it, smoked furiously. She exhaled with such force that Bobby almost expected to see smoke come from her ears as well as her nose and mouth. "I'd be finer if I could find a cocktail dress that didn't make me look like Elsie the cow. Once I was a size 6. Do you know that? Before I married your father, I was a size 6. Now look at me. Elsie the cow. Moby damn dick." "Mom, you're not big. In fact, just lately you look..." "Get out, Bobby. Please let Mother alone. I have a headache." That night he heard her crying again. The following day he saw her carefully packing one of the dresses into her luggage, the one with the thin straps. The other went back into its store box. "Gowns by Lucy of Bridgeport" was written across the front in elegant maroon script. On Monday night, Liz invited Ted Brodigan down to have dinner with them. Bobby loved his mother's meatloaf and usually asked for seconds, but on this occasion he had to work hard to stuff down a single piece. He was terrified that Ted would trance out and his mother would pitch a fit over it. His fear proved groundless. Ted spoke pleasantly of his childhood in New Jersey and when Bobby's mom asked him of his job in Hartford. To Bobby, he seemed less comfortable talking about accounting than he did reminiscing about slang as a kid, but his mom didn't appear to notice. Ted did ask for a second slice of meatloaf. When the meal was over and the table cleared, Liz gave Ted a list of telephone numbers, including those of Dr. Gordon, the Sterling House Summer Rec Office, and the Warwick Hotel. "If there are any problems, I want to hear from you. Okay?" Ted nodded. "Okay." "Bobby, no big worries?" She put her hand briefly on his forehead the way she used to do when he complained of feeling feverish. "Nope, we'll have a blast, won't we, Mr. Brodigan?" "Oh, call him Ted," Liz almost snapped. "If he's going to be sleeping in our living room, I guess I better call him Ted, too." "May I?" "Indeed you may. Let it be Ted from this moment on." He smiled. Bobby thought it was a sweet smile, open and friendly. He didn't understand how anyone could resist it. But his mother could and did. Even now, while she was returning Ted's smile, he saw the hand with the Kleenex in it tightening and loosening in its old familiar gesture of anxious displeasure. One of her absolute favorite sayings now came to Bobby's mind. "I'd trust him, or her, as far as I could sling a piano. And from now on, I'm Liz." She held out a hand across the table, and they shook like people meeting for the first time. Except, Bobby knew his mother's mind was already made up on the subject of Ted Brodigan. If her back hadn't been against the wall, she never would have trusted Bobby with him, not in a million years. She opened her purse and took out a plain white envelope. "There's $10 in here," she said, handing the envelope to Ted. "You boys will want to eat out at least one night, I expect. Bobby likes the Colony Diner, if that's all right with you, and you may want to take in a movie as well. I don't know what else there might be, but it's best to have a little cushion, don't you think?"
"Always better safe than sorry," Ted agreed, tucking the envelope carefully into the front pocket of his slacks. "But I don't expect we'll go through anything like $10 in 3 days, will we, Bobby?"
"Gee, no, I don't see how we could."
"Waste not, want not," Liz said. It was another of her favorites, right up there with "The Fool and His Money Soon Parted." She plucked a cigarette out of the pack on a table beside the sofa and lit it with a hand which was not quite steady.
"You boys will be fine. Probably have a better time than I will."
Looking at her ragged, bitten fingernails, Bobby thought, "That's for sure." His mom and the others were going to Providence in Mr. Biderman's car, and the next morning at 7 o'clock, Liz and Bobby Garfield stood on the porch waiting for it to show up. The air had that early hazy hush that meant the hot days of summer had arrived. From Asher Avenue came the hoot and rumble of heavy going-to-work traffic, but down here on Broad there was only the occasional passing car or delivery truck. Bobby could hear the hisha, hisha of lawn sprinklers, and from the other side of the block the endless roof, roof, roof of Bowser. Bowser sounded the same, whether it was June or January. To Bobby Garfield, Bowser seemed as changeless as God.
"You don't have to wait out here with me, you know," Liz said. She was wearing a light coat and smoking a cigarette. She had on a little more makeup than usual, but Bobby thought he could still detect shadows under her eyes. She had passed another restless night.
"I don't mind. I hope it's all right leaving you with him.
I wish you wouldn't worry. Ted's a good guy, Mom."
She made a little humphing noise. There was a twinkle of chrome from the bottom of the hill as Mr. Biderman's Mercury, not vulgar exactly, but a boat of a car all the same, turned onto their street from Commonwealth and came up the hill toward 149.
"There he is, there he is," his mom said, sounding nervous and excited. She bent down. "Give me a little smooch, Bobby. I don't want to kiss you and smear my lipstick."
Bobby put his hand on her arm and lightly kissed her cheek. He smelled her hair, the perfume she was wearing, her face powder. He would never kiss her with that same unshadowed love again. She gave him a vague little smile, not looking at him, looking instead at Mr. Biderman's boat of a Merc, which swerved gracefully across the street and pulled up at the curb in front of the house. She reached for her two suitcases. Two seemed a lot for 2 days, Bobby thought, although he supposed the fancy dress took up a good deal of space in one of them, but he already had them by the handles. "Those are too heavy, Bobby. You'll trip on the steps."
"No," he said, "I won't."
She gave him a distracted look, then waved to Mr. Biderman and went toward the car, high heels clacking. Bobby followed, trying not to grimace at the weight of the suitcases. What had she put in them, clothes or bricks? He got them down to the sidewalk without having to stop and rest, at least. Mr. Biderman was out of the car by then, first putting a casual kiss on his mother's cheek, then shaking out the key that opened the trunk.
"How you doing, sport? How's the boy?"
Mr. Biderman always called Bobby sport.
"Lug him around back and I'll slide him in. Women always have to bring the farm, don't they? Well, you know the old saying, can't live with him, can't shoot him outside the state of Montana."
He bared his teeth in a grin that made Bobby think of Jack in Lord of the Flies.
"Want me to take one?"
"I've got him,"
Bobby said. He trudged grimly in Mr. Biderman's wake, shoulders aching the back of his neck, hot and starting to sweat.
Mr. Biderman opened the trunk, plucked the suitcases from Bobby's hands, and slid them in with the rest of the luggage. Behind them, his mom was looking in the back window and talking with the other two men who were going. She laughed at something one of them said. To Bobby, the laugh sounded about as real as a wooden leg. Mr. Biderman closed the trunk and looked down at Bobby. He was a narrow man with a wide